I firmly believe you need not one but two people sitting on a board that can see the company through a digital lens. Having someone on the board with a digital mindset that could sit there anyway, I'm not suggesting grow and grab a millennial and throw them on the board. This is someone that can sit on a board in their own right. But they are digitally literate, that one, they can train the board in how to interpret and translate all these things that are being brought to their attention. It's always about, does it make the boat go faster?
Welcome to an encore podcast presentation from Forbes Books at forbesbooks.com.
I am, by the way, Greg Stebbin, and I'll be doing an interview with you and Harper, and I'm really excited to talk with you. Thanks for spending the time with us.
Pleasure. And, it must be podcast week, because I've got asked to do another podcast this week on the back of some content I promoted on LinkedIn, so it seems to be podcast month.
Well, I think every day is podcast day, frankly. I mean, we seem to be taking over the world.
Well, I'm experimenting with video. I just bought myself a proper green screen. I was doing some tests this afternoon. I can actually superimpose myself in front of funky places I've taken pictures of. So I'm going to start doing some vignette, sort of 2 to 3 minute video stuff to complement my blog. So I'm going to try that as a technology.
Well, so Andrew Grill, can we just officially say this interview has already begun? Because I hate to lose that little pearl you just shared right there. And a couple questions I have for you. You are a practical futurist. Yeah. And I know you're the former global managing partner at IBM. Is your company name the Practical Futurist, or you are a Practical Futurist?
I am a Practical Futurist, but whenever I'm asked to write which company I work for on conference badges, I'm very cheeky and I put the Practical Futurist, and I have keynote speaker, and I have people wandering around saying, "Are you speaking today?" So no, I'm not speaking. I'm the Practical Futurist, who is a keynote speaker. So I'm a bit cheeky like that. But I come from a world where, back in Australia in 1999, I was working for a telco called Telstra. And we were going to do something really funky on e-commerce. We're going to print our own business cards. And I threatened, but I never did, print my cards that were going to say Director of WoW. So titles are fun, but once you talk to someone, you get to know what they do. But I've got to tell you that the title Practical Futurist, it stops people in their tracks. They say, "What is that? I know what a futurist is. What's a practical futurist?" So that always gets the conversation flowing.
Well, it's so funny you just said that about being at a party, because we could talk for hours. I mean, we could, but we're not going to. So that forces us to be sort of, you know, we kind of have to drill into things and be specific. And the question that came out of my mind after I went to your website, which is andrew.london, I went to your website and I looked at things you speak about, and I looked at the places you've been and the companies you've worked for, former global managing partner at IBM. You've worked with American Express, the BBC, Nestle, Telstra, you just mentioned, Vodafone. And the question that came to mind was, when you're at a party and people ask, "Oh, Andrew, what do you do?" What do you say?
Well, I use that practical futurist terminology because, again, it opens a dialogue. And the practical word at the front is very deliberate, because I actually use this example in my talks. Arthur C. Clarke was a very famous British futurist from the 70s and 80s. He famously wrote Space Odyssey 2001. And in 1974, he was actually asked by an Australian journalist what life would be like in the year 2001. And when you watch this video, which actually is the play at the very beginning of the Jobs movie, it's a 3-minute black and white interview. He gets it pretty right. He predicts everything except the iPhone 10. He talks about the fact that we'll have a computer in our home, we can work anywhere we want. He even covers the societal impacts of technology. But he sees things 30 years in advance. And generally, the people I'm in front of that have invested time or money to hear me speak don't have 30 years, they don't have 30 months, they don't have 30 weeks. They want to know next week, what can they do? I just got off the phone this morning from a client briefing, and part of the sell into them was that it's a bunch of CEOs from a large company all meeting in Brussels in June. I'm going to give them three things that they are going to do in the next 30 days, and the group CEO is going to hold them to it. So the word practical futurist is, yes, I want to see the near-term future. I need to know about these new technologies, but what does this mean for your business, and what can you do about it next week? And that seems to be far more valuable than, "Hey, we're all going to be in flying cars and hyperloops." That's great, but that's not in my business lifetime.
And frankly, you can't really do much about it in the next week or the next 30 days either.
Correct, yeah.
So the other thing that jumped out at me from your website is this this statement, and I'm just going to read it because you probably spent a lot of time writing this and getting it exactly the way you want it. So why should I mess with it? The statement is, and by the way, grammatically, it's a challenge because it starts with a numeral. The statement is 100% digital. Andrew believes that to get digital, you need to be digital.
Yeah.
And I think you just hit it on the head about what can you do in the next week? What can you do in the next month? Because I think a lot of people are waiting until stuff works out to go for it. And what you're really saying is, no, you got to go for it to make stuff work out.
Yeah. And that's my mantra: to get digital, need to be digital. And the whole 100% digital, I could claim that about 8 years ago, I used to do lots of long haul flights from London to Sydney. And I would take lots of newspapers with me. And I found that I would take 5 or 6 newspapers. I get off the plane with very, very dark hands because of the ink on the newsprint. And that was my business case to my wife to say, I think I need to buy an iPad. And so I bought my first iPad in 2010. And now I read and I consume everything online. But back to the statement, to get digital, you need to be digital. So I was online in 1983. And often in audiences, I have a show of hands. And I've been online for longer than some of the audience has been alive. I was dialing up to bulletin boards, and I play that dial-up sound, which 10 or 15 years ago we used to use. And people go, some of the audience go, yeah, I remember that. And there's a laughter that goes through the audience because they realize what it was like. And other people go, is that a fax machine? What is that? And I encourage people from all walks of life, from the CEO down to the person in the mailroom, you need to play with this stuff. So when I wanted to understand what Internet of Things, IoT, was, I looked around, and for $30, I could buy a kit. And in the mail, I got this red plastic thing that I hooked up to my iPhone. And as I moved it around, the sensors in that transmitted where it was in the world to my phone. I went, ah, now I get it. This whole Internet of Things means I can augment and I can instrument anything. And so when I wanted to find out how websites work, this is years ago, I built my own website and I played with DNS and all these sorts of things. And I play with URL shorteners. I've been online, as I said, since 1983. Been on using LinkedIn since 2004. I want to play with these things so I understand how they work and so I can authentically articulate how they might work to a business audience. So, again, being a practical futurist, you've got to break it down. You can't ask someone to code a website, but go and buy an IoT kit. Go and buy $20 worth of Bitcoin. Understand how it works. And only when you personally have done this, and I'm talking about a chief executive going and buying Bitcoin with his credit card or her credit card, only when you've done it personally, you have that aha moment and you go, I get it. And now I understand how this impacts my world, my business, my industry. So that is my mantra: to understand how to do this, you've got to actually have done it yourself and got your hands dirty.
That's great, Andrew. You know, that brings up another question that I had on my side. One of the things that I gathered from your website and kind of discussions that we've had prior was, you know, one of the comments you said to me was disrupt or be disrupted. Can you fill in the gaps of what you mean by that and candidly what you just talked about, right? You know, having your hands dirty in terms of really working with, whether it's a CEO working with crypto or new technology, kind of describe that and candidly how you, when you work with clients, what your mantra and what your belief is on that.
Yeah. So everyone understands the disruption is happening, and we have the overused examples. Everyone talks about Uber and Airbnb and Netflix. Those companies themselves have also had to disrupt themselves. If you look at how they started, Uber started as a limo sharing app. And when Travis and co worked out that not everyone wanted to share limos, they had to pivot and disrupt themselves. Netflix realized that when it became technically feasible to stream DVDs rather than send them in a brown envelope, they could do that. So these companies have had to constantly evolve. My clients tend to be, I mean, my ideal client is a client that is 100 years old. They're a large insurer, and they're very, very conservative, both in their business practices and their technological approach. But they know they've got to do something. And in fact, PricewaterhouseCoopers came out with a survey recently saying that the cost of inaction could be worse than disruption itself. They've seen that a number of industries still have 2 or 3 years and a few more cycles left before the incumbents come in and completely disrupt them. But I want chief executives to be kept awake at night saying, what are we doing to ourselves? What are we doing to understand how we can change our process? I spoke to a large telecommunications company recently. This is the internal part of the organization that actually sell cloud services to the rest of their group. And I said, do you know how easy it is to buy an Amazon cloud server? They said, yeah, we do. It takes about 3 or 4 hours to spin one up. It takes us a month. I said, there's a problem there. You need to disrupt yourselves. You may not get it down to a few hours. But if an organization can go and buy something off the shelf in hours and it takes you multiple days to do that, there's something wrong with that. And so I think everyone agrees that disruption is happening, and the Uber and these examples are overused. But for example, in insurance, there's an app that you probably are familiar with in your part of the world called Lemonade. You don't drink it, but it removes the friction from buying and claiming on insurance. And I actually showed a video, that the sort of 2-minute overview, at an insurance conference, and I had a very mixed reaction. The more senior of the group after I spoke said, that'll never happen in our industry. Most of their direct reports and people that reported to them said, I'm so glad you showed that video, because I want to show my CEO that it's that simple to remove the friction. And so what worries me is companies that say, arms folded, we're right, we've been doing this for plenty of years. Before IBM, I worked for 12 years of startups. There were 6 different startups over a 12-year period. So I know what it's like to work in a very agile way. I know what it's like not to have all the tools you need, not to have everyone booking your travel for you, not to have the biggest, fastest service. So I honestly say, you know, you've got to think like a startup, having been a startup and knowing what it's like. But I've got to tell you, it's not the technology. It comes down to culture. In all the organizations I speak with, the fear of disruption or the fear of not doing anything comes from a culture, because I think there are 3 types of people in every level of management. There are prayers, stayers, and players. The prayers are a few years away from retirement. They just hope to goodness that this goes away. The players are the ones that actively get involved and actually do this and get their hands dirty and practice what they preach. And the stayers are just sitting there with their eyes wide open, caught in the headlights, going, I don't know what to do. And so with those 3 types of groups, you need to get as many players into the system as you can move the prayers out and move the stayers to players. So it's more of a cultural issue sometimes than technology.
You know what's interesting, Andrew? We're talking with Andrew Grill. I'm also here with Harper Tucker, my Forbes Books colleague. Andrew is the practical futurist, as he will tell you anytime you go to an event or if you meet him at a party. His website is andrew.london. Don't be confused by that. It's not andrew.london.com. It's just andrew.london if you want to find out more about him, and you should, because there's a lot of great information there. Andrew is the former global managing partner at IBM. He spends a lot of time on the road now speaking. You can go see his calendar there. I did, and my jaw dropped when I realized where you're going and what you're speaking about and how full your calendar is, Andrew. I'm glad you brought up the point about culture. Because earlier when you were saying the CEO of the company should go buy $20 worth of Bitcoin, should play with artificial intelligence, should try on the VR mask, just to have a sense of, oh, what does this mean for my organization? And also, of course, what does this mean for my customers? Are they going to begin to expect this, or can we get ahead of the crowd in our industry by offering it before anyone else? But to bring it back to culture, the thing that I was really struck with, as you said, that is the CEO that gives their employees permission to experiment is the who experiments and then models that behavior for their employees. That's the company and the CEO that's leading the company that's always going to be on the cutting edge, because it's really going to empower employees to step up and say, there's this new thing and we should be looking at it and figuring out how to integrate it. And I'm wondering if that sort of CEO top level down conversation is part of what you share with the companies you speak with.
It is, but it's harder to move some of these more mature, let's say, business practitioners, because they've been doing it for a long time and they're probably millionaires. And so they don't like to always be told how to do things differently. But there's another way. And this is a nice segue into another thing I talk about called digital diversity. And there's discussions around the world about having boards that are comprised of diversity of color, diversity of gender, diversity of all sorts of things. I think there's another way to slice that, and that's digital diversity. I firmly believe you need not one but 2 people sitting on a board that can see the company through a digital lens. If I was given a dollar for every time a company said, we've just been to the West Coast of America, we've gone to see Google and Facebook and Twitter, and we've come back, we're going to be a digital company. And the next board meeting, it's back to normal. All the issues that were there last month are there this month, and they don't see about what they can do differently. Having someone on the board with a digital mindset that could sit there anyway, I'm not suggesting you go and grab a millennial and throw them on the board. This is someone that could sit on a board in their own right. But they are digitally literate, that one, they can train the board in how to interpret and translate all these things that are being brought to their attention. But secondly, they can say, no, we don't need to go and invest $20 million in artificial intelligence right now. We need to learn what it means and build our business processes. I heard a great expression on the weekend. A friend of mine had seen an Olympian speak at an event, and the Olympian said, it's always about, does it make the boat go faster? So everything that you're doing, whether you want to get another 100,000 followers on Twitter or be the first with an AR, VR headset, does it make the boat go faster? And it might be that leading from the top, leading from example, working out loud, being very transparent, means that you have more empowered employees. It means that the recruitment job is much easier because people are drawn to your company. And yes, the boat goes faster.
Well, and to follow up on what you just said, we're talking with Andrew Grill. He is the practical futurist. His website is andrew.london. He's the former global managing partner at IBM. He's done work with a lot of other very large, well, global brands, from Nestle to the BBC to American Express. Also, a four-time presenter at TEDx. I mean, your resume as a speaker and as an authority and thought leader in this space is legion. And I want to hit on something you mentioned about digital diversity, and that is, if your case for having people on your board who are digital practitioners is sound, I'm going to suggest that a lot of companies should be looking at you to fill that position.
Well, that's very kind of you, but there are 100 people like me that I know in just London that could do that. But you know what? They're nodding their heads and they agree with me and they're saying, that's a great idea. But Andrew, we're not looking to change our board for another couple of years. To which I shake my head and I go, but you won't be around in a couple of years. Again, does it make the boat go faster? What's the risk of saying, okay, abracadabra, we're going to create two more board positions. We have 12 at the moment. We're going to make it 14. But those extra two are going to make sure that they can help future-proof the organization. Mm-hmm. And so I've actually been trying to call the bluff. I've actually given a talk just on digital diversity to a bunch of law firm owners, to a bunch of investment people. They all nod politely at me, but the phone doesn't ring afterward. And either it's me personally, which I don't think it is, but I don't know that the other 99 people that I'm thinking of right now in London or in New York or Los Angeles and around the world, there are plenty of people that have the solid digital experience. And this is important. Digital and social is a new language, and I've taken the time to learn this new language, and I can translate this to a business audience. And I think there need to be more people like me that can play that translation role. So AI, Andrew, what does it mean for our firm? Do we need to spend money now? Do we need to invest? Do we need to change our business model and our business processes to be AI ready? Okay. We need to start that work now. And we're in April, so we need to look at budget because we're now looking at budget for 2019. Okay. Let's stop doing X and we'll do Y in a quick, agile way. And Andrew, your team, your group, we'll let you fail. We'll let you fail once and learn from it. We want to have a culture of allowing you to fail, but fail fast. There's this agile methodology that's been well documented in software methodology. It's done in 2-week sprints, small pieces of the puzzle are worked out. But you know what? If it doesn't work after 2 weeks, you've only lost 2 weeks of work, not 2 years and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of effort.
That's great, Andrew. You know, as I was thinking through that, and you kind of just articulated that, the thing that came to my mind was back to our earlier conversation, you talked a lot about culture. Do you think it's important for the CEO or the executives to already have in place the future, right? The digital impact that's coming or the disruption? Do they have to have, for lack of a better term, pain in that area or potential gain and opportunity, and just have developed that culture before working with somebody like you? Or are you kind of helping them through that process?
You're operating a live patient. So I don't think you can stop and say, we're going to pause the business for a month and we're going to close the shutters and we're going to have a bit of a think about what we're doing next. Yeah. You're working in a live patient. So whoever is advising them has to have the operating mask on and the boots and the gloves and everything else to help operate on that live patient. What I think you do need, though, is to not have people given an extra responsibility. The example I give is Brexit happening here in my part of the world. If you went to an organization and said, oh, by the way, you have a new project, you've got no additional funding, it's going to be monumentally disruptive to the business for the next 2 years, but you're doing that on top of your existing job, who would sign up to that? And that's what's happening with Brexit. So you have to actually say, you know, if we're going to plan for the future, we need people that are connected to the existing part of the business, but we need people able to operate and freewheel to sort of look a few more cycles ahead, come back to us and make a proposition. But the the sign of a good CEO is saying, I don't know all the answers, and this stuff I'm reading in the paper worries me. The stuff even recently about what's happened with Facebook and data, will we be able to use data in the same way? I mean, today I wrote a blog post saying that Facebook have now said that they are going to have the same privacy controls as the EU has mandated with GDPR. That means now that Facebook have said, we're going to offer the gold standard of privacy controls to all of our customers anywhere in the world. We're not going to give you the economy class because you're in America or Australia. We're going to give you the gold standard in the EU. That should be a wake-up call to any organization that processes customer data outside of Europe to say, wow, Facebook have called the bluff and they've said, we're going to do the gold standard. Why would we offer economy to people not in Europe?
Or can we afford to not match what Facebook is doing?
Yeah.
I mean, can, if Facebook is, they're not upping the ante for Facebook, they're upping the ante for the world. Can you afford to not match them and maybe even find a way to outdo them? I know it's the gold standard, but maybe there's even a way to innovate past that, which brings me to the last question I want to ask Andrew. And that is, you talked about this idea, which I think is so brilliant, of giving permission to fail and putting a deadline on it, like a 2-week deadline, because all you lose is 2 weeks. I mean, I think that's what you said. What do you lose? Yeah. You lose 2 weeks. Nobody's head is on the block if you fail. You're kind of almost laughing and saying, yeah, it may not work, which gives people even more freedom to innovate. But the question I want to ask is, if you don't give your organization permission to fail, what's the cost of that? Because if you don't try anything and you don't do anything new and you don't embrace the future, there's a huge cost to that. That's way more than 2 weeks. It could be the cost of your business.
Well, what happens is someone that is nimbler, doesn't have the legacy that you have and the cost base that you have, comes in and takes it away from you. I mean, just quickly, disruption happens because of three forces. One is there are high profits, and that's true in the taxi industry, in the media industry, in the hotel industry. Secondly, technology is there. So I can whip out my smartphone sitting on a London or a New York street, and I can have a pizza or a carton or a taxi delivered to me there and then and pay for it. But before, the high cost to entry was you had to have a taxi license and everything else. And the third thing is why disruption happened is because consumers demand it. So you should be looking closely at where do you have nimble competitors nipping at your heels? Maybe, as some banks have done, there's an example in Australia where one of the big banks, National Australia Bank, set up Nubank, and First Direct here in the UK is an offshoot of HSBC. Why not have, why not disrupt your own organization rather than have someone else do it for you? So that may be that you transfer the lower cost base to a different model, but you still keep it within your organization and you learn. There's a great example in Poland where the bank branch became the main brand because they did it so well.
We've been talking with Andrew Grill. I'm here with Harper Tucker, my colleague at Forbes Books. Andrew is the practical futurist. He's worked with many global brands, former global managing partner at IBM. He's worked with Nestle, BBC, American Express, Unilever, Vodafone. If you visit his website, it's at andrew.london, no.com there, just andrew.london. You'll see he speaks and is a thought leader on many, many topics. I'll list a couple here as we spoke about disrupt or be disrupted. Are you AI ready? And the thing I love, the idea of digital diversity, why you need digital practitioners on your board. And I would advocate for it being Andrew. But as he says, there's 100 people right there in London that could also fit the bill. But talk to Andrew first, as you've heard here. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us. Again, he's Andrew Grill, the practical futurist, and his website is andrew.london. Andrew, it's been great to talk with you today.
Greg and Harper, it's been a pleasure as well.
Thank you for listening to this Encore podcast presentation from Forbes Books at forbesbooks.com.